Chapter 8. The Orrery. Committee Sona. Equivalent Exchange. Pain was a warrior's boon companion, the inevitable consequence of a violent life. Ammon had tasted pain before, had known the agony of flesh torn by claw and blade, fire and shot. But the pain of his body rebuilding itself from the inside was a new and unwelcome sensation. Hathomat had promised he would feel no pain. But Hathomat lied. Ammon could feel every splintered fragment and grinding motion of bone within his spine as the Pavoni regrew his shattered skeletal architecture. No chemical or psychic balm could dull the searing fire within him. A white-hot rod of iron rammed from the base of his neck to his pelvis. Tension racked his body, pain crackling around regrown nerves like an electric current. He told himself pain was good, that pain was his body waking up to the fact it could feel. He no longer thought of the Pavoni adepts as healers, but excruciators. They trailed his golden support throne like sycophants as he willed it from his stormbird. Febrile ether winds circled the obsidian tower, chattering with machinations as the gunship leapt back into the air. The summit of the Primarch's tower was no longer an inflamed spike, but a flattened disk of glossy black stone, as though a scything blade had hacked away its spire with a single blow. The revealed surface was cut with intersecting lines and sigils Ammon did not recognize, mystic arrangements that sent involuntary muscular spasms around his ruined body. Magnus was waiting for him, kneeling with his back to him and clad in the robes of a Magister Templi of the Fellowships. "My lord," said Ammon. Magnus rose to his full height and turned towards him. The distracted air the Primarch had affected in Ammon's pyramid was entirely absent. This was the Primarch as Ammon had known and loved him in his prime. This was the Magnus who had conquered the mountain of Agoru, who had stood before the Emperor of Mankind with honour at Nicaea. The urge to kneel was overwhelming, and Ammon grunted in pain as his broken body tried to obey that ingrained imperative. "My son, my loyal equerry," said Magnus, coming forwards to lay a hand on Ammon's shoulder. "My friend." "My lord," said Ammon. "We begin anew today," said Magnus, moving to the cardinal points of the tower. As he moved from point to point, Ammon began to see the underlying form of the rapture woven into the fabric of the tower. Its scope was breathtaking. "What are we beginning?" said Ammon, his support throne sliding through the air towards the centre of the tower. "You were right," said Magnus, balletic as he moved between each runic sigil, careful not to disturb the geomantic significance of their relationships to one another. "I cannot go on like this. I didn't see it, too caught up in the notion of preservation at any cost. But now I see what must be done." Power was building in the tower, spreading upwards and flowing through every living soul within it. Ammon could feel its immaterial stone trembling with etheric resonances that set his teeth on edge. Spikes of pain shot up his back as the speed of the bone weaving within his spine increased. Seer sight flickered at the edge of his vision, ghost images of futures unwritten. A city of black glass where a soul went to war with itself, a mantle unlooked for and a purpose forged in death, the endless horizon of a world-spanning ocean that made him ache with yearning. Though it pained him to turn from such sights after so long spent in darkness, he quelled the visions. Now demanded his attention. Now was where the future would be forged. "What is happening?" he asked. "It is the power of new beginnings," said Magnus. "Potential churning in the ether as it seeks to be made real." "What are we beginning?" said Ammon once again. "How long has it been since we flew the great ocean together, my friend?" "Not since before the wolves murdered Prospero." "Too long, Ammon. Too long," said Magnus, animated with manic energy at the prospect of whatever plan he had in mind, yet stubbornly refused to divulge. "We once bestrode the stars like gods, you and I, remember? We were wanderers in space and time, brother explorers of the farthest shores. We beheld the births of galaxies and watched the dancers at the end of time gutter and die. We will do so again, my son. I have seen it. The Primarch's energy was infectious, and Amon felt his heart quicken at the prospect of flying the great ocean with his father, unbound from this frail and decaying prison of ruined meat and bone. "Where do we fly?" said Amon, rising through the enumerations, ready to loose his subtle body from his corporeal flesh. Magnus returned to Amon's side and knelt before him.
"Lorgar was right," he said. "You were right. To rebuild the law of Prospero will kill me. It is killing me. But I believe there is another way."
"What other way?"
"One you and I will create together," said Magnus, stepping back towards the center of his mystical convergence. "At a place I will show you, deep in the great ocean."
Amon blinked as he saw hundreds of figures surrounding them. Standing around the tower's circumference were the scribes he had last seen in the recreation of the Hall of Amun-Re, the least of his father's splintered soul shards. Some burned brightly, others guttered like candle stubs. As one, they walked towards the center of the tower and the hole from which they had been split. Some came with sure and confident strides, others with the limping gait of cripples. No longer were they hooded, and Amon felt his certainty falter at the sight of them. Every aspect of Magnus's soul was exposed, his greatness, his spite, his nobility, and his hubris. From the venal to the virtuous, the savage to the enlightened, no dark corner of his being remained unveiled.
"Now you see me for who I truly am," said Magnus.
Amon wanted to look away, to preserve the perfect ideal of the Crimson King. For what son ever desired to learn his father was less than the god he had dreamed?
"I can no longer be riven," said Magnus, as the scribes closed the noose on him. "I can no longer deny the truth of my mortality. Ahriman will succeed, and I will be one. Or he will fail, and I shall be nothing."
The first soul shard reached Magnus and stepped into him, became part of him once again. The Primarch threw back his head as, one by one, each of the star-bright shards walked into him. With every addition, Magnus grew taller, became more vital, more real. Piece by piece, the Crimson King began his renewal. Soon, those fragments of his soul that had been swept to the planet of the sorcerers were brought within. And now Magnus stood as a warrior god and scholar king, resplendent in battle plate of crimson and furs of dappled ermine. His skin shone with vitality, and but for the nimbus of pellucid light shimmering over his skin and a telling quality of dangerously vulnerable incompleteness, Amon would have sworn that the Magnus of old stood before him.
"My lord,"
he said, unashamed tears coursing down his cheeks,
"what do you require of me?"
Magnus knelt before Amon and took his paralyzed hands.
"We will build the greatest library ever known, greater than anything conceived by Ashurbanipal or Ptolemy Soter, one unconfined by walls of stone or restrictive Euclidean geometries. Together we will craft a legacy to eclipse even mythic Akasha in its ambition. Will you help me build it?"
"Yes," wept Amon. "I will."
"Then fly with me, my son," said Magnus, pouring his power into Amon. "And together we will craft the orrery."
Bones creaked and sinews strained. New nerves burst into life, and Amon threw his head back with a howl of agony. His subtle body lifted free, surging into the sky. And together they soared, father and son, their souls unbound and joyous as the great ocean opened up to them. Kamiti Sona. Promus had heard tales of it. Few among the Librarius had not. The truth or otherwise of its existence had never been openly acknowledged by the silent sisterhood. like a guilty secret between lovers. Yet here they were, approaching it. A Sykana jail. Its whereabouts was known only to the highest ranked of the sisterhood and the emperor himself. Its horrors went unrecorded, and its inmates were gladly forgotten. Circling at the farthest extent of a backwater system with no name, it orbited a dying star once every 243 years. Even with encrypted coordinates provided by a self-erasing flesh thrall branded with the mark of the white Talon Carder, they almost missed it. The Arethusa hung silent in the void alongside the Doramar. Neither ship had been granted permission to dock with the facility, which had angered Promus until he saw Committee Sona through his Stormbird's canopy. Almost no light illuminated the far reaches of the system, and at first he thought the prison had been constructed upon the remnants of a titanic asteroid. But as the distance between the Stormbird and prison shrank, Promus saw no natural forces of gravity, time, or pressure had created this place. Committee Sona was the city-sized debris from a cataclysmic explosion in an earlier epoch, an explosion that had set it adrift in the stars until Imperial might yoked and stabilized its orbit. Extrapolating the curvature of its upper surfaces, Promus guessed it had once been part of an impossibly vast sphere, a void station the size of a small moon. Its gnarled surfaces were a barely visible mix of black ice, geometric rock, and angular steel. Meters of permafrost coated its upper surface, from which rose ruined spires of sepulchral towers and funerary structures of subtly inhuman dimensions. The corpse of something wrought by alien minds. Frosted spars of dark metal jutted from its broken flanks, and fronds of drifting steelwork trailed from the base of the disemboweled structure. More than just a bleak place, it was a dead one, too. Promus could read nothing from Committee Sona. No minds, no life, no sense that anything but frozen emptiness might be found within. Not unexpected for a jail of the Silent Sisterhood, but still unsettling and discomforting for a psyker. Potent wards were at work, null arrays and blanking fields to keep high psi-function prisoners contained, prisoners presumably deemed too dangerous or too impossible to execute. Promus had no wish to set foot on Committee Sona, but the orders signed by Malkador bore the highest seal of authority.
"Who are these prisoners? What do they know?" he whispered, looking through the frosted glass on the canopy's side.
Yasu Nagasena's modified Aquila lander held station on his upper prow quarter, its swept forward wings matte black and emblazoned with a serpentine dragon. They had not spoken since their first meeting, save to confirm waypoints and rendezvous coordinates between the Arethusa and the Doramar. The memory of the lost Hulkenberg still lay between them, each man holding the other responsible for what had been sacrificed over Jupiter's baleful red eye. The Stormbird began climbing, following a previously inloaded approach vector. Committee Sona's boarding protocols were necessarily strict, especially for psychers. Promus gasped as the dampening effect of the psi field hit him, a cloying sensation that felt like being enveloped in impenetrable fog. His mortal senses were undimmed, but having his psychic sensibilities blunted was like being plunged thousands of meters underwater in an instant. Sounds became robbed of tone, tactile sensations felt secondhand, and his vision became bland and colorless, bereft of crisp vigor. Promus held the sides of his bucket seat in a crushing grip, as though the world might fade entirely if he did not hold on tightly enough. He was a warrior of the Legiones Astartes, and death held little terror to him, but being cut off from his higher senses left his mouth dry and his gut knotted with tension. The icy topside of Committee Sona raced beneath the gunship, meteor cratered and belching plumes of vapor like miniature cryovolcanoes. Whip antennae, rotating dishes and networks of null veins that smoked with dissipating immaterial energies, flashed past. But Promus ignored them, entranced by the sight of the vessel berthed on Committee Sona's dark side. Its outline was all but invisible, a silent hunter of the void. Unmarked by any identifying symbols, its hull was utterly black and non-reflective. Even denied his psi-sense, Promus felt the misery that bled from this ship. He did not know its name, only its designation. One of the black ships, a harvester of warlocks. He turned from its bilious silhouette as the inloaded flight data threw the Stormbird's engines into reverse and brought it to a rapid halt. A meter-thick blast door opened silently beneath it, and blazing stab lights shone into the void. A shaft wide enough for the Stormbird and Aquila to descend side by side was revealed, and both craft rotated on their center lines, engines vectoring to guide them down into Committee Sona. The black ship was lost to sight, and the bleak alien landscape of ice and hopelessness disappeared, replaced by a shaft of engine-scorched steel, hazard striping and blinking sodium strobes. Promus grunted as a crushing grip of ice clamped down on his mind. The psi wards beyond the prison were potent, but those within were merciless in their unstinting suppression. He barely felt the impact of the landing gear on planed rock, or the hard imposition of gravity. His armor pressed him to the seat, and every limb felt weighted with lead. Even the air felt oppressed, deprived of some vital animus by the stagnancy of the prison's environment. It took Promus an act of will to rise. Every movement was an effort, as though the fiber bundle muscles of his battle plate were resisting his every step. He made his way back to the troop compartment, where those elements of his command given leave to enter Committee Sona awaited. A dozen Vorax battle automata, under the command of Datasmith Vindicatrix, stood maglocked to the deck. Majos Videns sat at the rear of the compartment, clutching a pair of data slates to his chest, as far as possible from the hunched predatory cybernetics. Credence Araxi, the psychopathic master of Ursarix, was already inspecting the cybernetic warrior thralls under his command, issuing orders in barking lingua technis. His Lorica Thalax armor was painted a deep gold red, and the dome of his helm had been replaced with a crystal flex cowl that revealed the fleshless skull beneath. Promus marched past them without speaking, his mouth gummed and his throat compressed with thirst. The assault ramp lowered, and void cold air misted as it met the comparative warmth of the troop compartment. He swallowed his distaste and stepped down the ramp as though a welcome from the avenging sun Rebute Gilliman himself lay beyond. The drop shaft had brought the Stormbird and Aquila into an angular hangar of dull metal, the walls cut with imperial eagles over older, more angular engravings, like a hastily scrawled palimpsest. Moisture condensed on the cooling hulls of the aircraft, and huge vents clattered overhead as they finished decompression protocols. Nagasena's Aquila remained sealed, its gloss-black hull creaking as it expanded, the engine still throbbing with power. Promus saw its fuselage had been widened and strengthened beyond the customary specifications required for mortal dignitaries and officers. He turned from the lander as a detachment of dome-helmed Castellan battle automata entered the hangar chamber through an armoured vestibule. They advanced in perfect thudding lockstep. Carapace-mounted phosphor blasters smoked with heat and hissing blue flames burned in the perforated barrels of their incendines. A woman in form-fitting armour of bronze marched before them, a pair of swords sheathed crosswise at her back, and an ivory-plumed helm worked in the form of a hunting hawk nestled in the crook of her left arm. At the sight of the battle robots, the Vorax spread out behind Promus, limbs tense and agile bodies rocking back and forth. Vindicatrix, robed in midnight blue and encased in a rapidly unfolding harness array of glowing slates and manual control mechanisms, kept their aggression in check for now. Araxe and his blue-armored Ursarax fighters formed up behind Promus like sprinters awaiting a starting gun, ready to erupt into violence at a moment's notice. The Castellans kept coming, crashing to a halt 5 meters from Promus. He studied the woman. Her age was hard to judge, her skin firm and her jawline slender. But her eyes gave her away, empty and unreadable. Even in a prison complex expressly designed to annul psychers, she still stood out as a void in the world, a soulless pariah. Promus's skin crawled at the sight of her, unreasoning hatred generating an aggression response. His armor responded, but he suppressed its engaging combat systems, knowing his reaction was a purely animal response to the void where her soul should be. Her helm plume marked her as a senior within her order, but Promus saw no sign she had taken the vow of tranquility. At least he could talk to her and have her respond.
"I am Sister Caesarea," she said. "I am commandant of Committee Sona, and your kind is not welcome here."
"My name is Diopromus," he began. "I'm here at..."
"I know who you are," said Caesarea. "Do you imagine I would allow anyone of unconfirmed identity within this facility?"
"Well, then I will assume you know why we are here."
"She knows, yeah,"
said a gruff, laconic voice, coming from the direction of Nagasena's lander.
"She doesn't much like it, but she knows. Yeah, she does."
Promus recognized the accent, rich with acoustically prominent tones suited to the oral traditions of its speakers. Now he knew why the Aquila had been modified. Yasu Nagasena stepped down from the serpent-winged craft, behind a swaggering pack of five legionaries in fur-mantled plate, the colour of a midwinter's dawn over Fenris.
"Your men of ice are space wolves," said Promus.
Nagasena grinned and nodded.
"Allow me to present the warriors of Bodvar Biaki."
Sailing the great ocean was an ordeal for most travellers, something to be endured. But for Hathomart, it was a chance to directly connect with the source of his powers. Even fellowships whose star was in decline were empowered. The surging tides of the Empyrean had made the Pyrae into gods of hellfire, and bulkheads throughout the starship crackled with flames as the Kemet hurtled towards its uncertain destination. The Raptora shared a measure of that bellicose energy, while the seer sight of the Corvidae remained stubbornly cataracted. The Athenaeans knew balance, but the Pavoni, their powers waxed and waned with each ringing of the shipboard watch bells. And right now, the tides were against him.
"You are sure you can do this?" asked Lucius.
"Yes," said Hathomart.
"I don't feel anything."
"We haven't yet begun."
"Then you should start."
"I will," snapped Hathomart, "if you stop interrupting."
They sat facing one another in the centre of Hathomart's quarters, a chamber of mirrors that offered no respite from reflections. Lucius was armoured, his sword resting across his knees. Hathomart wore the powder-blue robes of the Pavoni. An Aurania circle of powdered Umbilicus venaris enclosed them, its cardinal points marked by crystals of rose quartz.
"Understand that once we begin, there is no turning back," said Hathomart.
"I don't turn back from anything," said Lucius.
And the horrific scars webbing his shaven skull squirmed like worms beneath the skin.
"I only ever go forwards."
Hathomart nodded. That much was obvious. The swordsman's aura was in constant flux, a seething hellstorm of conflicting emotions and razored desires that could never be satisfied. Life and death warred within him, the potential for immortality or eternal damnation. Only an iron discipline kept the storm within Lucius from consuming him utterly, a determination never to yield that only the truly insane could know.
"How are you even alive?" marvelled Hathomart.
"Can't you tell?" asked Lucius. "I thought your order were all about the workings of meat."
"Adepts of the Pavoni know a great many things, but we are not gods."
"Funny. I get the feeling that's exactly what you think you are,"
said Lucius, his almost reptilian eyes flicking towards the walls of mirrors.
"A raging narcissist if ever I saw one, and I've seen the very best of them."
"Says the man seeking to be beautiful again."
"There is a shortage of great beauty in this sterile galaxy," said Lucius with a simpering grin. It will be a shame to deprive it of mine a minute longer than necessary.
You cut your own face off, said Hathelbart. Tell me why you mutilated yourself so completely. And speak truly. It will make my task that much harder if you lie.
I wanted to make myself ugly, said Lucius,
without shame or hesitation. Why?
Because a dead man spoiled my perfect beauty with his fist, said Lucius. And if I couldn't be perfectly beautiful, I would be perfectly ugly.
Then we are kindred spirits, said Hathelmart. Lucius nodded.
You shall begin, brother.
Hathelmart let out a calming breath and eased his mind into the seventh enumeration. Picture yourself as you were, as you would wish to be again, he said. Let no other thought enter your mind. Let no other desire touch you.
Why not?
As within, so without.
Done.
Hathelmart slid heightened awareness of flesh into the swordsman's body. His initial reaction was one of disgust. Oily skin, dense muscle mass, meat and gristle, ossified bones and blue, glistening organs that had no place inside this grotesquely enlarged transhuman frame. And every part of it rotting to pulp with every breath. This was unstoppable entropic decay, a countdown to extinction. Slowly, Hathelmart descended into the sixth enumeration, letting his disgust ebb as the true genius of the Emperor's design opened up to him. In an age of peace, a legionary might endure for millennia or more, but he would not live forever. The immortality of the legions was a myth. Eventually, the biological mechanisms sustaining them would fail, and the horrifying descent into decrepitude would begin. Traditional life-prolonging drugs and surgery were ineffective on transhuman physiology. Martial cults spoke of a warrior's legacy as his immortality, but Hathelmart wanted more. Death held little terror for him, but the infirmities of age and the weaknesses of a failing body were a constant horror. The artes of the Pavoni had kept him beautiful, had allowed him to avoid the bland homogenization of features common to warriors of the legions. It had kept him unique, but it couldn't last forever. He had looked to Ahriman to save him, to save them all, but Ahriman had failed. Despite everything, Sobek had died, reduced to nothing more than fine dust. He knew Ahriman held him responsible for their failure. The great chief librarian was unable to see past his own limitations and was sure to place the blame squarely on Hathelmart. Ever since Sobek's death, he felt Ahriman giving him sidelong glances when he thought Hathelmart wasn't looking, suspicious and jealous. A sigh of frustration escaped as he felt his grip on this most delicate level of perception slip. Quelling thoughts of Ahriman, he forced himself to concentrate on the task at hand. Lucius had cut deep. Flesh had a long memory, and the pain of its disfigurement was still strong. It surfaced in his own features, and Hathelmart flinched as he felt his skin burn with repercussive pain. That, too, could be managed. Hathelmart allowed his will to be guided by the swordsman's absurdly simplistic view of himself. Chiseled jaw, strong cheeks, wide eyes, noble brow and aquiline nose. The most beautiful hero imaginable. Lucius cried out as the bones of his skull cracked under Hathelmart's ether sculpting. Cells long since ruined were rendered functional. Withered veins and arteries ripened with newly flowing hyper-oxygenated blood. Poorly healed breaks were erased as bruised musculature smoothed and soft tissue was reshaped to make Lucius more beautiful than he had ever been in reality. With the underlying structure restored, the gouged scars receded into waxen flesh as the swordsman's dead skin mask was peeled away to reveal a face Hathelmart had last seen upon the grand dais at Ullinor. The connection between them broke, and Hathelmart groaned, the aftershocks of so great an expenditure of power racking him with pain as his etheric humours sought balance. "It is done," he sighed. Lucius lifted his hands to his face, fingertips exploring his new features like a blind man. His chest heaved in a series of hyperventilating exhalations that turned to bubbling, hysterical laughter. Lucius stood, and his new reflection stared back from a host of gleaming mirrors in an infinitely regressing mise en abîme. Beautiful and perfect in every detail. The very image of Fulgrim himself. The swordsman was long gone, and war musters rang throughout the Kemet's decks, but Hathormat remained confined within his chambers. Of all the disciplines of the fellowships, biomancy took the greatest toll on its practitioner, and the Pavoni law of equivalent exchange was unequivocal. To obtain, something of equal value must be lost. Lucius had a new face, and Hathormat was paying the price for that, but having so sublime a warrior in his debt would be worth the pain. He still felt what the Phoenician's warrior had done to himself with a shard of broken glass, still felt skin and muscle parting before its edge. His face felt wet with blood, but when he touched his fingers to his cheeks, they came away dry. Hathormat drew in a fearful breath. His fingers were trembling as though palsied.
"Repercussions are normal,"
he said, drawing his hands into fists and rising to the first enumeration.
"To be expected."
Hathormat sent restorative power down through his arms, healing ruptured cells and halting the tremors in his hands. Bladework calluses on the heels of his palms and middle fingers faded as his skin renewed itself. He exhaled slowly, as Araman's voice resonated within his skull. Even drained by his workings, he heard the chief librarian's excitement.
"Hathormat, I need you on the embarkation deck. The fellowships are mustering."
"You have a destination?"
"Better. I have brought us where we need to be."
"I shall be there directly,"
he sent. But Araman had already broken the link between them. Hathormat stood and smoothed his robes, and a sickening wave of nausea swept through him. Multiple images flooded his perception, like a host of transparencies overlaid on top of one another. He fell to his knees, hands flat on the floor, and his sensory assault instantly ceased. Hathorbart drew in a panicked breath, blinking away the dizzying sense memory of his chambers viewed from a host of skewed angles. Undulant pressure squirmed in his palms, and he rocked back on his haunches, drawing his hands into fists and resting them on his knees. Slowly he turned his wrists and opened his hands.
"Please, no,"
he whispered. Unblinking, myopic eyes stared up at him from his palms and every one of his fingertips.